Hi, I'm Heidi Jo Castro, and welcome to The Stream. The role of artificial intelligence has long been debated in military communities. But with recent leapfrog advancements in the technology, discussions about the role of AI in warfare are gaining urgency. So today we ask, is an AI arms race underway? As always, we want to hear from you, so please be sure to share your thoughts and questions on our YouTube chat. Joining us to discuss from Washington, D.C., Paul Shari, author of Four Battlegrounds, Power in the Age of Artificial Intelligence. With us from London, Melanie Garson, Cyber Policy Lead and Director of Geopolitics at the Tony Blair Institute for Global Change. And with us from San Jose, Costa Rica, Matt Mahmoudi, researcher and advisor on artificial intelligence and human rights with Amnesty International. Thank you to our guests for joining us today. Melanie, I'd like to first start with the question, why are we here? Are we really facing an AI arms race?
Thank you, and it's good to join you. I think the way we frame AI arms race, we have to be really careful. Yes, there are races to different parts of harnessing AI, but being careful to understand that it's a system of systems. So what we're seeing recently with a lot of the narrative is there's races to underpin different parts of the processes of that, whether that large language models or standing algorithms or the parts or components. And there will be sort of a rush to different parts of the whole technologies. Mm-hmm. But I think it's, we have to be careful of thinking about it's not just the race to the kind of imagery that we have of AI weaponry.
Well, we do know global leaders have talked about this a lot, right? Coming from the U.S., from China, from Russia. President Putin even saying previously that the nation that leads in AI will be, quote, the ruler of the world. But Paul, I want to come to you for this question about practical things. How are militaries currently already using AI?
Well, we're certainly seeing militaries around the world adopting AI. In fact, it's already being used in the war in Ukraine. Mm. AI is so widely available. It's not just advanced militaries that are using AI. Even civilians can get their hands on AI technology. So we've seen, for example, civilian drone operators in Ukraine that are working with the Ukrainian military using small quadcopter drones have used AI tools that are available online for free and embedded these into the drones for things like image recognition. So when the drone is looking down on the ground with a camera, it's not just human eyes. It's also the AI is looking through this camera and detecting objects. That's a truck. That's a tank. That's a very valuable tool in warfare. But is it an arms race? I have to agree with Melanie. The reality is we're not seeing it when we look at spending. It's about 1% of the U.S. military spending. That's not an arms race. It's not even a priority, if we're being honest.
Right. Right now, the ways that it is being used is data analysis, right, and surveillance. The data analytics firm Palantir has developed a tool to help commanders make battlefield decisions. Here's a video of how that works.
The footage confirms a potential threat. The drone footage shows an enemy T-80 main battle tank. Generate three courses of action to target this enemy equipment. The operator uses AIP to generate three possible courses of action to target this enemy equipment. Next, they use AIP to automatically send these options up the chain of command. Send these three options to my commander for review.
If you listen closely to that description, key here is that still the decisions are being taken by humans. However, the Pentagon said in January that it will allow the development of AI that can make kill shots on their own. And so I wanted to point to my laptop where there's some examples of what is in development. This is the U.S. Air Force designing a combat system where human-piloted fighters will eventually fly in tandem with drone wingmen. We have here Russia and the U.S. developing drone submarines. This one you're seeing here is the unmanned 85-foot Orca developed by the U.S. Navy, which will be used to lay sea mines. This video, it's a little bit out there, but the Australian Army is testing telepathic robot dogs. They do not need voice commands because the operator wears a headset that detects brain waves and the robot dog complies. And finally, a real current example, again, we're talking about Russia and Ukraine. Russia says it's deployed the Marker unmanned ground vehicle in Ukraine. It's supposed to automatically recognize Western tanks and destroy them. Matt, I would like to come to you next. We see all these AI advancements, in development at least, in the air, on the ground, in the seas. What are your concerns?
Well, first of all, I think pointing to the fact that, as Melanie said, these are systems of systems, is really important because part of the narrative around AI means that we fall into this trap of basically thinking that these systems are new and haven't been in development for a long time. And as you just pointed to, it's been a debate that has been standing for a couple of decades now. In particular, in the sort of weaponization space, in the military space, we've been talking about this from the angle of autonomous weapon systems. Mm-hmm. I think it's really important to understand that from that angle, because what we see is that there are unique risks that are posed by these systems, which consist of various components that are being deployed and have been deployed, again, over the last two decades. That includes systems such as facial recognition. It includes systems like predictive analytics. It includes systems such as emotion recognition. These get paired up with other more advanced computer vision technologies and deployed in things such as drones, in things like air defense systems. And we've seen time and time again that despite the fact that they make bold claims about what is possible in conditions of warfare, mm-hmm. they end up either falling short or leading to disastrous consequences. We only have to go as far as to the 27th of March in 2020 under the Libyan prime minister, where autonomous aerial vehicles were used to shut down logistics convoys. We saw a number of different examples in which civilians were effectively becoming casualties of these systems. Right. And this is, again, a largely sort of, I guess, nascent debate around systems that have longstanding records in terms of the research that show that they invariably violate our human rights. They violate our rights to privacy, our rights to equality and non-discrimination. We saw how facial recognition technologies was used against Black Lives Matter protesters at large following the murder of George Floyd. Imagine now systems that are weaponized using the same technologies, which are biased and which also, when not biased, are used in contexts that are discriminatory institutionally. That can only lead to the further erosion of our rights. And this is why it's so important to tackle those technologies, you know, discreetly before we get into sort of this existentialist debate on AI as sort of taking over the world.
And Matt, you brought up the development of fully autonomous weapons, which is something that militaries across the world are looking at. Paul, what is the line between semi-autonomous weapons, which are currently used in combat, and fully autonomous? And have we crossed that line yet?
Well, we're getting close. And certainly, you know, the systems we have today, and you showed pictures of many of the different robotic systems that are in development, undersea, in the air, are still controlled by people. Humans are still directing them. In that video, humans are in the loop making decisions. Very few countries, and really none of the leading military nations, have ruled out fully autonomous weapons that will be making their own decisions about whom to kill on the battlefield. And that technology exists today. All it takes is for somebody to put it together. There were some videos that came out in Ukraine last summer that showed all of the components of the technology. Humans were still in charge, but really all it takes is for humans to just step out of that loop. Yeah. And then we begin to cross that threshold where machines are making their own decisions on the battlefield about whom to kill.
Yeah. Melanie, I want you to watch this video with us. It is about it's an arms dealers who are actively promoting new AI-powered tools to potential customers. And here's one sales pitch heard at the UAE's International Defense Exhibition in February.
We've been focusing on developing autonomous, sovereign autonomous capabilities, across air, land, and sea. And we've been busy even developing our own AI capabilities as well. Because as you can see and you tell from what's happening around the world, I mean, modern warfare requirements is changing from time to time. So we need to make sure that we are always updating ourselves with the latest technology in the market. And we develop our own market to make sure that our autonomous products meet the customer requirement at all times.
Melanie, what does the arms industry, and even the tech industry for that matter, what do they stand to gain from selling this AI tech to militaries?
There are, without a doubt, lots of advantages to using AI-enabled processes within warfare, both for good and for some of the risks, with the inherent risks that comes with. AI-enabled processes will massively help, and we're actually already seeing this going back to Russia-Ukraine, in logistics planning, which is always one of the biggest challenges for any military, knowing how to get where to what at what point. Mm-hmm. It can help in situational analysis. So there's areas that it can make actually warfare more accurate. By the same token, it can make warfare faster. It's the accountability challenges mm-hmm. can be more difficult. I think in the clip we just saw, and I think it's some of the dangers we'd say, we have to be careful of a bit of the snake oil. So what sort of a red flag for me is definitely thinking, well, we need to know, what the customer wants, because actually the reality of every battlefield is different. Training the data to be able to suit, and this is one of the great challenges we're going to see with some of the using AI in the battlefield, is that it relies on having massive amounts of training data to be able to act in a specific circumstance. And what we know about battlefields is those circumstances are never the same. And that's going to be one of the challenges, which is why, as Paul pointed out, most of the processes we see today, most of the weaponry we see today, still need to keep the human somewhat in the loop. So it's very mm-hmm. much, what is the purpose of that technology for?
Yeah, and this training material, it itself can be biased and it can be flawed. So there is the risk of AI defense systems responding to a false alarm. Branka Mirjan is a researcher at the Canadian Peace Research Institute, and she sent us this comment.
There's a lot of discussion about AI bias or that AI hallucinates or simply makes things up. And those concerns are really acute in a complex and dynamic environment that a war zone is. After all, we're talking about, decisions over human lives potentially. And so I think what's really key to understand is the role of AI in transforming human decision making, and particularly the use of AI in weapon systems. And there is an ongoing discussion at the UN on autonomous weapon systems, which really has focused on issues of human control. So ensuring that humans are the ones that are ultimately making decisions to select and engage targets, and also accountability, so that we can hold someone accountable for the decisions that are made by a system, by an AI system.
Matt, if a machine makes a lethal mistake, how do we hold it accountable?
I think it's important to understand that those systems were both built and operated by particular actors. I think our current discussion has been focusing so much on what technologies are capable of, and to some extent the biases that are built within it, but we haven't actually talked about regulations and safeguards. And that's really striking to me, given that the focus on reliability and precision of these systems distracts us from the harms that these systems cause, and ultimately gets us away from what we need to be talking about when it comes to AI systems at large, which is about exactly what you're mentioning here, which is accountability. So both the companies that are developing the technologies, the actors that are using the technologies, the national context within which the technology is operating, who are effectively the responsible party developing the legislative framework under which the technology can be used, all have a shared responsibility in effectively the kinds of deaths that this might lead to, or the kinds of maiming that it might lead to, because of course we see that too. What we have to understand is that even when the reliability of these systems are perfected in a sort of a hypothetical scenario, we will potentially giving way for compounded forms of discriminatory violence and chilling effects. We're looking at things such as institutional racism, biases in terms of xenophobia, ableism that manifest within these systems, things that underpin how we conduct warfare against certain individuals and groups that may harbor particular appearances that appear to match stereotypes that we have about what enemy combatants look like. And so you can only imagine how historically marginalized communities in particular end up being at the sharpest end of the knife that is AI military applications.
Yeah, and I promise we will talk about regulations in a moment to come. But first, Paul, I wanted to smear this discussion to the threat of nuclear warfare. Now, this is not something that people are saying is imminent. However, we have to at least touch on this. To be clear, no one is saying AI should be offered the nuclear codes. That is not what we're talking about. But it could inadvertently escalate conflicts.
Well, people are concerned as we see militaries adopt AI. What are the lines, whether it's autonomous weapons or really for the most consequential and destructive weapons that we have, nuclear weapons? How do we ensure that AI is nowhere near the nuclear launch codes? If we've got humans in the loop on anything related to nuclear decision making. Now, what's fascinating is this is now official U.S. government policy. It came out last fall in the U.S. Defense Department's Nuclear Posture Review that a human will always be in the loop for all information relating to decisions involving using nuclear weapons. Mm. But we haven't seen that from all nuclear countries. We haven't seen statements from Russia or China about what are their policies going to be. Mm. I think that's, you know, when we think about cooperation and avoiding harms from military AI, that seems like a pretty low bar to clear. That's like a great starting point to say, hey, we all agree humans need to be in control of anything related to nuclear weapons, and maybe we can build from there. And it would be great to see other nuclear armed countries adopt a similar policy.
Right.
I think.
Go ahead, Melanie.
Sorry. No, I think that's a really valid point. I think in the conversation, the assumption that we don't have control at this point to decide where we employ a weapon in any given time and who we keep on control of that, and where we have the baseline, like we have the taboos in other weaponry, and we have precedents for using that, that there is a steady base for cooperation and for agreements to be built forward on this.
And there has been a little bit of movement on this. Matt, maybe you want to jump back in here. The recent summits, the RE-AIM summit hosted by the Netherlands and South Korea earlier this year, did that result in some action toward regulating AI in the military?
Again, the focus of those conferences or summits and the focus of largely the discussion around military AI has been around the responsible uses of AI. I think that's dangerous because by talking about responsible uses of AI in a military context, we're assuming inevitability and we're moving away from thinking about questions such as, should any of these technologies be used in those contexts at all? And that's an important question to ask, given that many of, again, the component technologies that make up the larger system of, for example, autonomous weapon systems have records, dire records of human rights harms caused by their usage by, for example, police forces in cities. But they don't have records showing that they're generating greater efficiencies or leading to lowering crime, which is often the sorts of narratives that are espoused by various law enforcement agencies, and actually the kinds of AI fantasy, the sort of techno-utopian fantasies that exist out there are largely based on, again, snake oil, to borrow Melanie's term here. And I think that's again, it's telling for us that coming into those spaces, it's assuming inevitability rather than assuming that there is a conversation to be had about regulation. So just being conscious that that's where we need to bring it back to, and the kinds of narrative that we also see around the existential angle of AI, right? That like actually it's going to get access to the nuclear codes, and before we know it, the planet is going to be destroyed, whilst an important conversation also once again distracts from the harms that are documented and happening on an everyday basis related to systems like facial recognition, gait recognition, emotion recognition, mm-hmm. predictive analytics used as predictive policing. So we need to return to ways of regulating those technologies as well, whilst having this larger conversation too.
Yeah, and I want to get into deepfakes in a minute, but you mentioned that you believe this isn't inevitable. However, there are many who may disagree and think that the genie is now out of the bottle. One of them is the computer scientist and AI pioneer, the godfather of AI, as some have called him, Geoffrey Hinton, who spoke in May about the urgent need for the world to come together to rein in AI.
For the existential threat, the idea it might wipe us all out, that's like nuclear weapons, because nuclear weapons had the possibility they would just wipe out everybody. And that's why people could cooperate on preventing that. And for the existential threat, I think maybe the US and China and Europe and Japan can all cooperate on trying to avoid that existential threat. But the question is, how should they do that? And I think stopping development isn't feasible.
Well, in our last remaining minutes, I don't want to neglect the possibility of misinformation, not the possibility, but the reality that it's happening. One example is a video that went viral in January featuring so-called American Pan-Africanists supporting a military coup in Burkina Faso. Here's a brief example.
Hello to the African people, and particularly to the Burkina people.
We are Americans from Africa. And we are Pan-Africanist.
We appeal to the solidarity of the African people and the people of Burkina Faso to effectively support the authorities of the transition.
We must support the patriotic movement for safeguard and restoration and President Ibrahim Traore, who imposes respect for his sovereignty. Let us all remain mobilized behind the Burkina people in this common struggle. Homeland or death, we shall overcome.
Melanie, some may watch that and laugh because it is so obviously fake. However, it does have the potential of doing real harm, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. There is the, with any form of manipulation of and the use of generative AI, whether it's through the word or through imagery, has the potential to impact both democratic resilience, trust in information as a whole, which can be part of the breakdown of how we operate in both in elections, like you saw in this system, but in any form of decision making in our lives. But there are, that doesn't mean it's either inevitable. So in some of the ways, some of the same processes that generate the problem are also part of the processes that can help us tackle the problem and find solutions to it.
Yeah. Well, at least the conversation is happening worldwide. But Paul, I'm going to ask you the final question for today, and it is, what should we be most worried about at this moment?
I think we need to start thinking hard about regulating the most capable AI systems. And I don't know that we need to be distracted by, you know, theoretical concerns, but when you look at just practical concerns today, the most capable systems like GPT-4, the successor to ChatGPT, can synthesize chemical weapons. It's been demonstrated that it can help do that. It can be used as a cyber tool for offensive cyber attacks. That's the kind of technology that we don't necessarily want widely available to just anyone. Mm-hmm. And we need to start thinking about non-proliferation approaches to control this technology so that it doesn't get in the hands of terrorists and others who might cause harm with it.
Right. Well, there was another conference in Costa Rica in February. It was the first regional intergovernmental meeting on AI in the military, and they produced a communique calling for the urgent negotiation of a binding international treaty. So some progress, however, to urge for more negotiation perhaps is still a step that's not very advanced. That's all for the time we have today. I want to thank you to our three guests, Paul, Melanie, and Matt. Thank you for sharing with us your comments and your expertise, and we will see you next time.